Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument is Doe against Remish. Mr. Russomano.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Anthony Russomano. I represent defendants who are Wisconsin Department of Corrections officials. This case comes after summary judgment on cross appeal, and the issue presented is whether Wisconsin's sex offender registration statutory scheme violates the ex post facto prohibition on retroactive punishment. In these opening remarks, I intend to focus on the issue that the defendants are appealing, and that is a ruling that a fee provision in that statutory scheme violates the ex post facto clause. And that fee provision states that registrants have to pay $100 per year as an offset for monitoring costs, so the cost to run the program the scheme contemplates. The defendants submit that the district court erred when treating that fee provision differently and deciding that it was in fact a punishment as opposed to a non-punitive fee that is not subject to the ex post facto ban. I'd like to leave the court with two main points today. The first main point is that it's agreed by the plaintiffs, the registrants, by the defendants, and I believe by the district court that a Smith v. Doe legal framework applies here, and that's a 2003 U.S. Supreme Court case that sets out five main factors. You look at the circumstances or whatever the burden is you're looking at and deciding whether that is a punishment.
Before you get too far into the heart of your merits argument, I have a threshold question about Wisconsin's ability to impose this regulatory scheme on these petitioners. The Does live out of state, as I understand it. One's a resident and citizen of Connecticut, and the other a resident and citizen of Florida. So how is it that the Wisconsin registration requirement continues to apply to them? Aren't they subject to the federal scheme and the Florida scheme now?
Oh, well, Your Honor, I'll be honest, this is not something that they have raised in this case.
And well, so I understand that, but it may have a bearing on standing.
I understand, Your Honor. And so my caveat is it's not something I've researched. My understanding of how this scheme works is that Wisconsin continues to keep track of their information, and their registration information spans their personal identification, their place of employment, and now their place of residence out of state.
Well, I guess my question is not whether Wisconsin continues to keep track, but whether the obligation to register in Wisconsin continues to apply to them when they are no longer residents or citizens of the state. They're not domiciled there. They can't be subject to the criminal penalty for failure to register, I take it. Or maybe the state has a different position. I don't know, since it wasn't briefed.
I don't have a position on that, Your Honor. So I suppose all I can tell you is that Wisconsin does require the registration, and it has not been challenged as a matter of being in-state, out-of-state problem.
So the state's position is that these petitioners, the Does, are still under the regulatory jurisdiction of the state of Wisconsin for purposes of the registration requirement?
Yes, Your Honor.
And if they fail to register, the state would attempt to prosecute them?
Yes, and I can't comment on whether that would be successful, but that would be something they would consider, I assume, yes.
Now, is your argument that the fee is disproportionate to the cost of maintaining this system of registration?
Is that the plaintiff's argument? Your Honor, I don't believe so. And if it were their argument...
Oh, I'm sorry, you're the state, is that
yes,
it?
Yes,
okay.
But I could comment on that if you'd like.
I am interested whether it bears a relation to the cost of the registration system.
That's a good question, and the reason is that in fact, the statute and the administrative code provision that puts it into practice both state that the fee collected has to be an offset for costs, actual costs. And there's been no challenge or evidence or allegation in this case by the plaintiffs that it is not being used to offset actual costs. In other words, the plaintiffs who have the burden here to challenge it have not brought forth an argument.
Has anybody introduced data on the actual cost?
No, Your Honor. The defendants...
How was $100 calculated? Where did the number come from?
Well, Your Honor, that is not in the record, but if you'd allow me to go outside the record.
It must have come from a statute or a regulation.
Yes, Your Honor. There's a statute. It's 301.45. Yes.
So it's a statute.
Yes.
And do we know anything about how the legislature got that number?
We don't.
Suspiciously round.
I might add, it might be helpful, that it is a partial offset. So it's not intended to exactly overlap with the cost, but just
how
to offset some.
It's a partial offset. Yeah. If you don't know anything about the cost of running the system or the marginal cost imposed by an additional registrant, how do you know it's not 10 times the marginal cost or 50% the marginal cost?
Well, Your Honor,
you know it's a partial offset only if you know what the costs are.
I agree, Your Honor, and it's not in this record. So I'm not comfortable telling you the answer to that unless you're asking me to.
Well, what does the state do when someone registers?
As far as?
Posting on a website, putting it in some sort of computer record. What is the processing involved? That might cost $100
There are several
moving
parts. In the first instance, there's the initial collection of information. So we're talking about personal characteristics, where you live, where you work, et cetera. There's also a collection of internet information, internet identifiers, things like that. And that is then kept and organized by the department. There's also an updating of information, depending on the type of offense. It might be yearly, and it might be quarterly. And
isn't that probably automated?
Well, I believe not, Your Honor. It's all
it's
all on paper.
It's done by hand, by...
Yes, Your Honor. So it might, well, it's eventually computerized.
And, yeah.
But at the moment, there's actually paper notices sent out by the department to a registrant, right. And then they're asked, given notice.
Let me just interrupt for a second. Judge Easterbrook isn't feeling well. He may come back or not. If not, he'll listen to the arguments on our recording system, so it won't affect our consideration of the case. But I will preside. I'm next in line, so if I get sick, just decide over herself. Yeah.
To provide a more complete answer to your question, in addition to this collection of information and the updating, then the information is made available to various groups, and various subsets of that information needs to be organized and then siphoned out depending on the group who has access. Law enforcement's one group, could be child care or schools are another group, child care organizations, and then the public has access via the internet. And that information then needs to be put somewhere on the internet in a system. It needs to be infrastructure so public can access that information. Information's accurate. And all of these sources need to be updated. So someone needs to know, did something change? If so, I need to update my law enforcement access information. I need to update the internet information, and it needs to be maintained. So we're talking about working hours by people, and we're talking about physical or electronic infrastructure that comes with this scheme.
The program is supported by federal funds, as I understand it.
There may be some federal funds, Your Honor, but I don't know the answer to that question, to be honest.
I mean, most of these, or many of these, state registration schemes are linked to the Adam Walsh Act and SORNA.
Your Honor,
I believe they all work together.
I believe that's true. So my understanding, I'm not a SORNA expert, my understanding is SORNA set out the baseline, and then states went and implemented it, meeting that baseline or exceeding it to accomplish the goals set out in SORNA, and this is Wisconsin's version of that.
Right, but the federal government induces the states to comply by offering federal funds to support the state programs.
I believe that's true, Your Honor, yes. Before we leave the point on the absence of information about the actual costs. It's our position, the defendant's position, that that's a problem for the plaintiffs. If they wanted to challenge that the offset's not real, that in other words, the department's breaking the law. The law says you must, these are offset costs, offset fees. They have not said the department is breaking that law. They didn't bring that challenge here. There's no evidence that it's happening here. So I think our starting point is that it's an offset fee. And the question is, and the question that the district court answered was, is that offset fee, given that it's offset, is that a punishment? I think that's the issue presented to this court, because it would have been the plaintiff's obligation to come forward with a reason to explore this other topic about what are the numbers.
The district court construed this as a fine. What's wrong with that analysis?
Your Honor, to step back, I guess I have a two-part answer to that question. The first part is district court recognized and the plaintiffs recognized that the Smith v. Doe case controls the analysis here of an ex post facto question. That case sets out five main factors to consider. Those look at the circumstances of the particular burden you're looking at here, a fee. None of those factors set out a fine fee dichotomy based on what the district court noted. And this is where the district court went awry, we believe, that the district court, although it acknowledged Smith v. Doe case controlled, didn't go ahead and meaningfully apply those factors when it came to the fee. Rather, the court seemed to apply a bright-line test. And that test seems to ask, does the fee result in a direct benefit to the payer? In other words, does the registrant get something back that they want? And if the answer is no...
That's sort of a perverse analysis in this context, isn't it?
Well, yes, Your Honor, and that's why...
The Does are not applying for government services here or receiving government services in any meaningful sense of that concept.
And we haven't argued otherwise, but our argument is that's not the test. The question is not whether you get something in return, and if the answer is no, then it's a punishment and it's illegal. The answer is you look at the five factors, and none of those factors ask if there's a direct benefit to the person who is subject to the regulatory burden. In the Smith case, the court made it clear that the people subject to Alaska's sex offender registry scheme didn't like it.
Now, what you're saying is you can impose a fee because someone is imposing a cost, right? Not just that the person is getting something for the fee. Know what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor. Under the particular factor under Smith that this would fit, yes, that it's and the factor it would fit under is it's rational to recoup costs from someone who's creating a cost. And in this case, there's no evidence it's excessive. So there are two factors. But yes, and you would still look at the other factors. So this game's not over. But the other factors then you would look at, take them all together, is this a punishment? And none of those factors, again, say, do the people paying or being burdened get a benefit?
Okay, so this is enough on the fees, right?
Okay.
So we should hear from the other side about their challenge.
Okay, I will sit down. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Resimano. Mr. Dupuy?
Good morning. May it please the Court. I'd like to immediately address the question that Judge Sykes raised, which is whether the scheme can be or is applied extraterritorially. And I'd point the Court to there's a statute I'd point the Court to a series of letters that I'm going to go through briefly with you where the state asserts repeatedly that our clients are subject to all of the restrictions that we have challenged here, including the fee.
No, I know as a matter of fact that
right.
The state is asserting authority to regulate your clients.
Right.
My question is one of law.
Right. And I think that, again, the question, I'd point you to the venue statute, Wisconsin 971-19 sub 9, which again says that they can assert jurisdiction. It says in an action under 30145, which is the statute we're discussing, if the defendant does not have a county of residence in the state at this time that the complaint is filed, the defendant may be tried in any county in which he or she has resided while subject to the registry, or in the county in which he or she was convicted for the sex offense. And then Wisconsin's territorial jurisdiction statute, which is 93903, provides that a person is subject to prosecution in any if any of the constituent elements of the crime take place in the state, or if there is an effect, a consequence in the state. So the Wisconsin courts have said that this extends the territorial protection principle to its limit. Whether there are some constitutional problems with a prosecution or venue problems with the prosecution, that may be, but at least as far as our clients are concerned, they view themselves as definitely at risk of prosecution by the state.
As definitely what?
At risk of prosecution. And they have obviously complied with all of these requirements because they felt that it was they were facing jeopardy if they did not.
So there's no standing problem. They have been threatened with prosecution, effectively.
Effectively in the sense that there is a statute that the state purports applies to them, and that is, you know, by the terms of the statute and by the terms of Wisconsin's venue and jurisdiction statutes.
Well, it's not really a question of venue. It's really a question of extraterritorial criminal jurisdiction. And
which is 939.
But I thought you were just challenging this as retroactive, not...
That's correct.
Nothing to do with where they are.
We're not.
You're not.
But the point is whether there's a standing issue, I think.
No, I understand. That's okay. Jurisdiction.
And which part of this extraterritorial criminal jurisdiction statute would cover this?
I believe
it's not the first part, which is the constituent elements of the crime take place.
Actually, it might. If the constituent elements provision has been read extremely broadly, so that even forming the mens rea in the state, even if all of the actus reus occurs elsewhere, the state has held that that's sufficient to confer criminal jurisdiction in this state.
So it would be sub A.
Well, sub A and also sub C, which is while the person, out of the state, the person doesn't act with the intent that it caused in this state a consequence set forth in the section defining a crime. Arguably, I would say at least the failure to provide evidence that is or information that is supposed to come into the state of Wisconsin, that is a consequence in the state of Wisconsin.
Well, for the protection of the people of the state of Wisconsin, and if your clients are not in the state.
I guess what the state might argue is that if they were attempting a prosecution here, they might say, in fact, there is an effect here because our people need to know where somebody is at any time, and they might come back to the state.
Okay.
So I'd like to now focus on our main appeal. And our position is that this case is not just a repeat of Smith v. Doe. Wisconsin's ever-expanding and tightening web of restraints, requirements, and burdens goes far beyond those that were imposed by Alaska's simple registration and passive notification laws, creating, in effect, a whole new form of lifetime criminal supervision.
Well, you have to be more specific than that.
Well, right. And what I'd like to do is walk you through, if
well,
I may.
Well, pick on what you think are the worst.
Pardon me?
You're not going to have time to go through all of them.
Pardon me?
You're not going to have time to go through all of them, so pick out the worst.
Okay, well, what I would say is the most extreme problems with this registration and restriction scheme are the bans on things that normal people in society can do every day without constraint.
Those
taking pictures
those
of their children.
Those aren't implicated here. Those are prospective criminal penalties.
No, they're restraints on them just as much as the requirement to come in and provide.
But isn't that really a First Amendment issue?
Well, it involves First Amendment.
Or, you know, changing your name or taking pictures. I don't know if it's First Amendment or what. But I don't think really your objection is that it's punishment. It's sort of a gratuitous interference with what people consider to be elementary rights of, you know, personhood, being able to do things.
Well, correct.
Even and if that's it's not punishment, right?
Well, isn't punishment ultimately, though, the infliction, the restriction of liberty or the imposition of fines?
No, I don't. It doesn't sound like, if you have a law which says no one can take pictures, and it's goofy, but I don't know that I wouldn't call it punishment, right?
Well, it's
I mean, suppose Chicago became obsessed with privacy. Obsessed. It is already obsessed. And it said no one can take a picture without the consent of the person photographed, right? Can't take a picture on the street.
This is not just consent.
No, wait, listen to me. Yeah. Right? Now there would be something deeply wrong with that, but it would not be punishment, right? It would be prophylactic. Right? It wouldn't be punishment.
But there comes a point when
the
scheme of restrictions...
Right? The point is, it's a gratuitous... Well, maybe it's not gratuitous. In my example, no picture taken, not the consent of the subject. Maybe that's, you know, it's a deprivation of liberty without due process. Maybe it interferes with the First Amendment. It violates free speech. But it's not punishment.
Well, but the nature of punishment... First, let me say that it's not just...
It's not my example. It's not punishment. How could it be punishment?
It could be... If the question under
Smith... Because then you're saying every regulation of behavior...
No.
...can be evaluated... If it goes too far, you're going to call it punishment.
Well, that is effectively the analysis of Smith, is if the restrictions and restraints... cross a line, you go from civil regulation to punishment. Pew has said it's a matter of degree. It's a multi-factor test. And when you talk about, and the restraint here is not just getting consent. It's getting informed, written consent. In other words, it has the face-to-face embarrassment factor of saying...
Suppose state of Illinois passed a law which says... Nobody can change his name, period. It's too confusing. You gotta stick with whatever you were born with, that's your name for life. Now, that might be impermissible on various grounds, but it wouldn't be punishment, it's just regulation.
Does there come a point at which the imposition of
restraints
on people...
My example is regulation. It is not punishment.
It's not tied to a crime.
It's paternalistic.
In part because it's not tied to crime. Here, it's tied directly to the fact that our clients have committed offenses long ago. All of these restraints.
Yeah, but it's the... I think Judge Sykes said this. But it's the imposition of... It is a restriction on future conduct designed to prevent future violations.
But that was true of Smith v. Doe as well. And Smith v. Doe said that the reason that the scheme was retroactive, it pointed to a statute, the coverage statute of their own scheme, which said that the law is retroactive because, basically, it applied to people who didn't exist.
You're missing the point of the line of questioning. All the 948 offenses would apply regardless of the registration requirement.
They're tied to the registration.
The 948.13 and 948.14 apply by virtue of your client's status as sex offenders.
948.14 applies because they are registrants. That's the coverage provision of the statute. It says you are covered if you are a registered sex offender.
948.13 applies
right, it does
regardless.
Not. That's a subset, effectively, of people
right.
who are registered.
So take that out of it.
Well, they're effectively, I would submit that, I mean, as the Supreme Court said in Smith, the analysis is, are these restraints, you analyze these restraints as they are felt by the people who are subject
yes,
to them.
Yes, but this restraint would be felt by them regardless of whether they're required to register. They can't work with children because they're sex offenders, not because they have to register.
No, but we're challenging the entire scheme of sex offender regulation that as it affects our clients, which is not just the registration. We didn't limit our challenge to that below. The court analyzed these provisions, and they operate retroactively even if they're not punished for them, because there are two ways you look at the – there are two punishments at issue here. The first punishment is the obvious punishment of getting sentenced for committing this crime. That's prospective because the law was in effect. But the restraints themselves can be punitive. That was the point of Smith v. Doe, saying if you go this far, if the case had had this in it, if the case had had this in it, direct restraints on employment, for example, that would be a different story. That could be punitive. And this, that's not what is happening. I mean, we have many more restraints than were in existence in Smith v. Doe. In addition to the photography and the...
So what's the criterion for a restraint? Is it the number that you're complaining about, or is it the, or is it a specific restraint?
Well, it's, we're challenging the scheme as a whole, but recognizing that it is composed of multiple parts that impose
restraints. So don't you have to pick out parts that are particularly restrictive or that have nothing to do with preventing future sex offenses? Don't you have to do that?
Well, not exactly. I mean, I think what you have to do is, again, say how is this felt by the individuals to whom
the
restraints apply.
That's awfully loose and vague.
That's the language directly out of Smith v. Doe.
Oh, forget Smith. Think about this case. It seems to me you can't just count up and say, well, there are more restrictions than there were in the Smith case, and therefore it's illegal, as if Smith had put a ceiling on the number of restrictions, which obviously it didn't do.
Right.
You have to, I think, pick out, I gave you ones I thought were pretty ridiculous, actually, ridiculous restrictions. It seems to me you have to pick out specific restrictions and say, this has nothing to do with preventing future sex offenses.
Or is excessive in relation to whatever.
Right, right. It's not a rational way of dealing with the.
Right. And I believe that that certainly you analyze individual functions, but again, there is this sense in which the entire scheme is remarkably close. If you look at the letters that our clients have received, remarkably close to criminal supervision. They are told they have to report every time they move, every time they change jobs, every time they get a new volunteer position. It's extremely close monitoring.
They can't be summarily thrown into prison or jail for violating.
No, that's true.
They have to get all of the normal criminal protections if they violate these regulatory requirements. So it's not analogous to probation or parole.
That is a difference. But as the Supreme Court said in Cummings, it's not the form, it's the substance that matters. And the substance here is a person ends up in prison one way or the other for doing something that any other human being could do without that risk. And the restraints here are on incredibly common behaviors. One of our clients, the victims were not children. They were not child sex offenses. He cannot take pictures of his children's soccer games. He cannot post them on Facebook just like everybody else can. He is shunned because of the operation of this scheme. And he is subject to potentially, in addition to these dozens of letters that they get every year telling them that you are subject to prosecution if you don't respond within 10 days, they also could be subjected to a requirement that they report anywhere that the state says they need to report if their appearance changes and they need a new picture at the state. And the restrictions go beyond that as well. There's the automatic email alerts that are available that were not available in Smith v. Doe, which makes it incredibly likely that our clients become immediately known by the worst thing that they ever did when they move into a community. And our clients have lost work and been shunned by new acquaintances as a result of this scheme.
Yeah, but the Supreme Court has already said that those kinds of community notification provisions in these registration schemes aren't punitive.
Well, those are different because that was a passive information setup where somebody, if you want to know if there's somebody in your neighborhood who has, you know, who is a sex offender, you go up to the website and you put in either the person's name or you put in the zip code and try to get this huge list of people who are sex offenders nearby and wade through them. This is different. It's pushed out directly to the...
Right, it makes it more readily accessible.
It's not just readily accessible. It's an immediate alert so that you're much more likely to have the neighbor who says, oh, here comes this person. I'm going to tell everybody else in the neighborhood they're a sex offender and they're going to be shunned, rather than having to sort of actively go to a depository of that, although on the Internet, is still an active effort to
go
out and find
it. So it makes the system more transparent and user-friendly by members of the community to the extent that they're given notice as opposed to having to search out the information on their own initiative. Why does that make a difference for ex post facto purposes?
Well, I think it makes it much more likely that you're going to end up with face-to-face shunning and shaming. And that's a relevant consideration because that's a traditional form of punishment. And
so the inability to maintain obscurity is a restraint.
It's not the inability to... I mean, their information is out there and it's available to people. But the reality is our clients go into a new community and immediately somebody knows. They can't even make the initial human contact.
Wait, I'm sorry, I've lost the thread. What provision are you talking about now?
This is the family watchdog active notifications that go out
right.
to people. And I think that contributes to the shaming effect of the
Well, wait,
the
I didn't understand. So family watchdog, that's something that people who are worried about this stuff, they look up, right?
Family watch.
It's not sent to all the neighbors or anything like that. You have to look it up, right?
No, you just have to register one time, and then you get automatic alerts.
I'm talking about the people who, the neighbors, they click on Family Watchdog to find out where the sexual offenders live
actually,
in the neighborhood.
Actually, what happens is you go to you actually just go
to
the...
Wait a second. Isn't it true the neighbors, they have to click on Family Watchdog, right?
Only the first time.
Well,
and then from then on they get immediate notification.
Let me finish.
Sure.
I had never heard of Family Watchdog until yesterday when my law clerk showed me Family Watchdog. Okay, now I know about Family Watchdog. But when a sex offender moves into a neighborhood, you don't notify all the neighbors, do you?
No.
Go look on Family Watchdog. You've got a dog in your neighborhood now, right? Don't you, as a neighbor, have to make an independent decision whether you're going to look at Family Watchdog?
Only the first time. Because
I don't know what you mean by the first time.
Because you go, you sign up to get email alerts that are sent to you without going back to Family Watchdog. And what happens is Family Watchdog sends you an email saying a new sex offender has moved into your neighborhood. It's not going back to the
Family
Watchdog.
I see. So you have to. So are you told about? I don't know. Maybe. Apparently we in Chicago have Family Watchdog too. But are people in Wisconsin, are they told about Family Watchdog, or
yes.
They just have to hear about it?
If you first go on the website of the Sex Offender Registry,
no,
it says you can get
that,
email
but
alerts.
But told about these registries? Are Wisconsinites told, if you're interested in sex offenders in your neighborhood, you register with Family Watchdog? Or do people, or this just, a few people know about this and are, maybe they're paranoid about this and so they register.
I don't know if there's an advertising effort other than the existence of the website itself.
It's not like the Do Not Call list where, you know, there's like a huge
promotional
PSA
campaign. Not that I am personally aware of.
But it operates like the Do Not Call list. You have to actually affirmatively opt in.
You have to opt in the first time, yes.
As far as we know and as far as the record reflects, most people in Wisconsin are ignorant of this option to opt into these email alerts.
And as Judge Posner indicated, it's not just opting. I mean, it's not just Wisconsin. It's many other states.
Right.
So let me just ask, and, you know, we'll give you time. So don't worry about that. What was the 10 days that you were talking about? Because I know there's a 10-day provision about moving to another state, but are you talking about another 10-day provision?
There are two provisions that are 10 days. One is you have to notify the state if you're going to take a job in another state or if you're going to, which can have an effect on our client, particularly the client who's a contractor, gets a contract job in another state. They say you got to do it in 10 days. Oh, I can't do that. But there's that, which is the prior notice. And then the second is any change, even if it doesn't involve changing states, in address or anything else, has to be – actually, there are three.
And name and so on.
You have to make those notifications within 10 days. And then finally, these random notifications that can be sent out requesting verification or the quarterly requests for verification that are just standard for lifetime sex offenders, if you don't respond within 10 days – if you don't respond within 10 days, you can again be prosecuted for failure to do so.
Okay. Could
I ask one more question?
Yes, sure.
How do the requirements in Wisconsin compare to what your clients are obligated to do under the Florida and Connecticut systems, and under SORNA for that matter?
Well, SORNA would only directly affect interstate moves, I believe, in terms of...
Right, but SORNA imposes the same sorts of obligations prior to interstate travel.
Right, the notice provisions are similar. Again, there's nothing in SORNA like the photography ban. There's nothing in SORNA like the name change or pseudonym ban, which is broader than just name changes. I mean, name changes, yes, you have to get an official name change, you have to go to court anyway, but pseudonyms, you can't use a nickname, you can't use all kinds of things. You can't be Publius and write a letter to the editor.
So how does that compare with what your clients have to do in Florida and Connecticut?
To my knowledge, those provisions that I just mentioned do not exist in Connecticut.
What do they have to do in Florida and Connecticut?
They have to respond to requests for information.
They have to register periodically and update their registration?
Yes, they do.
With address change information, job change information,
correct.
Physical
right.
appearance
all,
change
all
information.
All of those things are things that were in existence in the Alaska statute. And we wouldn't be here challenging the scheme if this were the same as the Alaska scheme or even, you know, basically modifying the number.
Right, but how do the Florida and Connecticut schemes compare to Alaska's? Do they impose additional requirements over and above what was at issue in Alaska in the Supreme Court?
I believe Florida does empower the police to go out to somebody's house and, you know, check up on them every so often.
And what about these in-person requirements? Are those in place in Florida and Connecticut as well?
Not in Connecticut I don't believe, but I'm not sure. And Florida, I think they do have an in-person reporting requirement.
Okay, thank you, Mr. DePuy. Mr. Russomano. I don't understand the photography prohibition. It seems preposterous. So this is for people who this applies to all sex offenders, right? Not just the child sex offenders. And they can't take a picture of any child, even if it's. I don't understand. What is that about?
Well, there's...
You worry about adult sex offenders, sex offenders who are not pedophiles. You're worried about them converting to pedophiles and starting to take pictures of little children or what?
Well, I think the best way to answer that is that it's looking at sex offenders as a class, to something that's permissible.
Come on. There's a big difference between pedophiles, which is a small proportion of men, I think like 1 in 1,000, and the whole class of sex offenders, which is very large. So why would you assume that all sex offenders are potential child sex offenders? And even if you thought that, what does the photography have to do with it? I mean, you could... One thing, it's not like it's just photos of nude children or children engaged in sexual acts or anything like that.
Well, Your Honor, I would explain the reasoning like this. First, it's rational to think that the minors are more vulnerable than the average person, just as a general proposition. It's also rational to think that sex offenders, as a general matter, pose risks to others. And so you pair those together. You're protecting...
Is there any empirical basis for this?
Your Honor, I don't know.
Why don't you say they shouldn't be permitted to take pictures of women?
Well, Your Honor, this is a legislative judgment call.
Yeah, but it seems irrational. Why aren't all women, maybe all young women, potential victims of sex offenders? So why should they be permitted to take pictures of them?
I don't know why that legislation...
Right, it doesn't have any reason behind it. I don't know who thought of it. Do you have any comment on the amicus curiae brief, which says that there is no empirical basis for these restrictions?
Well, Your Honor, I don't have any...
A very low level of recidivism among sex offenders, and no evidence that these restrictions reduce the incidence of sex offense?
My answer has to be that I don't have contrary empirical evidence, because no record was developed in the district court on that topic, because that really wasn't...
Well, you could have responded to their brief.
Well, it's our view that the issues raised in the amicus brief are questions, are issues that might be relevant for legislature saying whether it's
yes,
wise or not.
Yes, but legislatures aren't permitted to act with total arbitrariness, are they?
No, Your Honor.
So if someone comes along and says, look, this is nonsense, this photo thing, and indeed other restrictions, there's no empirical basis for them. In fact, studies by responsible social scientists suggest that these restrictions have no utility at all. They don't have any effect on sex offenders. They even make the argument this increases sex offenses, because the restrictions on employment, which are the consequence of these restrictions, makes these people more likely to be criminals, because they don't have any lawful opportunities.
Well, Your Honor, I guess my answer to that is the question isn't whether there are certain studies out there that say what you're describing.
Why isn't that the question? Suppose there are very convincing studies which say, actually, you end up with more sex offenses, because the restrictions you impose on these people, they can't get employment, they become increasingly antisocial and take it out on children or women or what have you. I have no idea whether it's true. But suppose all the studies showed that, there's nothing contrary, and as a result, the only reasonable conclusion would be that these laws, these restrictions actually increase the number of sex offenses.
Well, Your Honor,
would it still be reasonable, rational for the legislature to say, we don't care what the truth is. We're not interested in truth. We just have this feeling the more restrictions you pile on these people, the less sex offense there is. We know that everybody who studies it disagrees with us, but we don't care.
Well, Your Honor, it might be two things might be true. One might be it might be true that these studies show, these particular studies show, that there's an ill effect from this work restriction. But it might also be true that there's another desirable effect in the eyes of the legislature. That is, you keep offenders, and the work restriction, I should note, is only applicable to child sex offenders, to keep these people away from this vulnerable population. Now, that might have other collateral consequences to that sex offender's life, but it obtains the initial goal, which is keeping them away. So that is rational.
Now, what does that mean, bring them away?
Well, someone
they
who
moved somewhere else and prey on other people. I don't get that.
Well, what I had in mind, Your Honor, is that this class of people that have been convicted of a child sex offense, it's rational to think it's not desirable to have them working as a day in and day out with minors, because that exposes them to close relationships.
True. I was focusing on the more extreme one, the photos, and also the change of name. I don't understand. You're not allowed to change your name?
I do have an explanation for the name change provision, Your Honor, and that is the goal of the registry is to collect information, organize it, and make it available so that the public or law enforcement can reliably access it and know who in their community is a sex offender. If someone's allowed to change their name, all of a sudden all these records are now have one name and then they switch over to another name. It could...
I don't understand. Why don't you just add the new name to the record, which has the old name? So people who look up the old name will see old name, the name this person, what you thought was the name, well, it's now a new name, right? It's all in the it's all in the same record, right?
Well,
in fact, if you look at my one glance at Family Watchdog, it listed the person's name, and then it listed the aliases.
And I believe that would have been the day they entered the program, then that was their alias going back historically. Going forward, the goal is to have one name. So,
but
for
I don't understand. Yeah, I can understand, of course, why you require the person to notify your website of a change in name, and then you add the new name to the website. So, what's the problem?
And my answer, and this is a bit of a riff on what I just stated, but it's rational to think that. At one point, I know that Joe X is a sex offender, and I want to be able to rely on that information going forward. And I know I can rely on it. I don't have to keep figuring out if someone is a new name, employers, neighborhood people.
Well, maybe then if you've registered for Family Watchdog or whatever the Wisconsin counterpart is, once you've registered, then as soon as the person informs the state that he's changed his name, you all email the registrant, that is the person who's subscribed to Family Watchdog, that this person has another name. What's the big deal?
Well, Your Honor, I can't disagree that there are other possible ways of structuring the
Well, it's a tremendous restriction to say you can't change your name. I mean, what if you want to get married and change your name? There are very few female sex offenders, but there are some. They can't change, they can't use their husband's name. Huh?
And I suppose my answer
What's
to that
point?
Would...
I mean, it's so extreme. There doesn't seem to be any thought behind it. No discriminations, just piling on.
Well, my answer to that would be if you were to get to the analysis of an ex post facto punishment, which I think was discussed earlier, this isn't an ex post facto problem, but if you were, the restraint question is really a different, this may have a burden imposed as a consequence, but the restraint question is really, are we talking about something like imprisonment? That's what we're talking about when we talk about a punishment. The name change, if you wanted to get married, might be disappointing and a burden, and you don't like it. But it's not like imprisonment. No, I don't think anyone would argue that.
Right. This is an ex post facto challenge. This isn't a substantive challenge to any of these regulations. And anybody who's subject to any of these regulations can bring a substantive constitutional challenge to the requirements if and when they are prosecuted for violating them. They can challenge them on First Amendment grounds or any other constitutional grounds. And so the challenge here is really very narrowly focused on the ex post facto question, whether the totality of these restrictions constitutes retroactive punishment. And that's governed by the Supreme Court's decision in the Alaska case. It's not a freestanding inquiry into whether these regulations pass constitutional muster as a substantive matter.
I agree with that statement, Your Honor. So that in our perspective, in our briefing, we have not
explored that. Well, what if your statute required people, who sex offenders, to wear a sign on their chest, "I am a sex offender"? Is that would you say, well, that's okay because that's, or it's okay under the ex post facto clause because that's not punishment?
Well, Your Honor.
Well, yes or no?
You'd have to go through the factors.
No, answer my question.
It may be.
That is not an answer. Do you regard that as a form of punishment?
It's the amount of time. May I continue?
Would you answer my question? Why would I ask you a question and not want you to answer it because the red light had gone on?
I apologize, Your Honor.
Why do lawyers keep that? Repeating that formula. Do you want me to answer? No, I want you to go away. So now tell me, is that punishment or is it not punishment?
The way you describe it, yes. It seems to be holding someone up for face-to-face harassment or shame.
No, it's warning. It's warning the public. The public that doesn't know about Family Watchdog. Sees this person walking around its neighborhood, "I am a sex offender," and you tell your children, don't go near that person, he's a sex offender, maybe dangerous, right? So why doesn't it fit the rationale of your law?
Well, I think it crosses the line in this way.
How? Okay, go ahead.
As described, and I'm relying on the Smith discussion as my baseline here, the Smith court made a distinction between simply making information available, and then someone else looks at the information and says, "I don't like that person." That's not punishing. That's not the state punishing.
Well, this is just making information available. This is a convicted sex offender.
But it goes further because it doesn't. It puts it out there. No one sees it.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. That's what you want to do. Put it out there so people know about it, and they don't have to have heard of Family Watchdog in order to be protected against these people.
Well, Your Honor, I think that there is a line there. At least the Supreme Court sees
a line. What is the line?
The line is that at some point, if you are putting a label on someone so that everywhere they go and everyone they see says, "You're a sex offender, I don't like you," you've impacted their life so much that it becomes like a punishment.
But don't you think this collection of restrictions affects people's lives a lot? Can't change your name, can't take pictures of children, have to keep sending in notices with 10-day deadlines. If you miss it, you're going to be prosecuted and this and that and the other thing. It's quite a collection of... Each restriction is lesser than the one I've hypothesized, the sign around you. But collectively, they're pretty formidable.
Well, Your Honor, I'll put aside the ones that, in our opinion, don't pose ex post facto problems themselves, the work and photo and name ones. And the rest of those, it's our position that they don't go any further in substance than the restrictions discussed in the Smith v. Doe case. That is the 10-day verification. That's asking them to say, yes or no, do you still live here, work here? It's a way of making the scheme work.
Yeah, but Mr. Dupuy's point is that when you add them all up, it's overkill and punitive in effect. It has the same effects on these people as supervised release.
Well, I disagree with that position because it's not asking someone to verify if they live in...
That's one. Now add them all up and think about how you'd feel if you were subject to this regime.
Your Honor, it is a burden. The question is it like imprisonment or something that is like a punishment?
Well, the sign isn't like imprisonment either, right?
No, Your Honor, but it is a traditional aim of punishment to put someone up on a soapbox and point at them and say...
Well, you're putting him on a website soapbox.
Except that the public can go there and choose to look, but it's not...
Yeah,
you know, that's a line
of people look. Okay, well, we'll have to conclude. It's taken an awfully long time. So thank you very much to both counsel.
I think Mr. Dupuy had some rebuttal time because of the cross appeal.
Well, you want to say something more?
If I could.
If you must, all right.
I'd like to briefly mention one of the restraints that hasn't come up, which is the effective expulsion of our clients from social media as a result of the requirement that they provide the government with all of their internet identifiers, which are then passed on to social media providers with the express purpose of having them expelled.
Right, but that's by virtue of third-party action. That's because Facebook has...
It's very different, though. In Smith v. Doe, the third party actions there were, again, the data was just up on a website, and it was public data that was already in the public domain, and anybody could go and get it, or nobody could go and get it. Here, the data is very specific and non-public data. Nobody has to... Their identifiers are not public information. That information is taken from them and given directly to an actor for the purpose and to enable that actor to expel them. It's as though if Alaska had taken the telephone number of an individual and given it to Verizon and said, please take this person off of your telephone registry. I'd also just like to encourage the court just to get a flavor of how, I mean, the appendix is probably longer than it should have been, but to look at how this really affects our clients. Look at all the letters that they get. There's in plaintiff's appendix, page 35, 36, 49, 50, and 51. It goes through this whole litany of what they're getting, most of which is stuff that did not exist in the other scheme. And I see that my time is up. I'd ask that you reverse the district court.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Dupuy. Were you appointed or retained?
This is the ACLU.
I came into the case on appeal. We don't charge... money.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.